O my Lord, Sri Krishna, son of Vasudeva, all-pervading personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. I meditate upon Lord Sri Krishna because he is the absolute truth and the primeval cause of all causes of the creation, maintenance and destruction of the manifested universes. He is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations, and he is independent because there is no other cause beyond him. It is he only who first imparted the Vedic knowledge unto the heart of Brahmaji, the original living being. By him, even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion, as one is bewildered by the illusory representations of water seen in fire, or land seen on water. Only because of him do the material universes, temporarily manifested by the reactions of the three modes of nature, appear factual, although they are unreal. I therefore meditate upon him, Lord Sri Krishna, who is eternally existent in the transcendental abode, which is forever free from the illusory representations of the material world. I meditate upon him, for he is the absolute truth. Unless one surrenders unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, it is certain that he will be bewildered. When an intelligent man surrenders unto the lotus feet of Krishna and knows completely that Krishna is the cause of all causes, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, then only can such an intelligent man become a Mahatma, or great soul. But such a great soul is rarely seen. Only the Mahatmas can understand that the Supreme Lord is the primeval cause of all creations. He is Parama, or ultimate truth, because all other truths are relative to him. He is omniscient. For him there is no illusion. Some Mayavadi scholars argue that Srimad Bhagavatam is not compiled by Srila Vyasadeva. And some of them suggest that this book is a modern creation written by someone named Bhupadev in order to refute. I believe it should be Bhupadev, and maybe it was changed to Vop. It's V. Maybe it was changed to V because someone thought it was Srila Prabhupada's Bengali, but I believe it is Bhupadev. In order to refute such meaningless arguments, Sri Sridhar Swami points out that there is reference to the Bhagavatam in many of the oldest Puranas. This first shloka of the Bhagavatam begins with the Gayatri Mantra. There is reference to this in the Matsya Purana, which is the oldest Purana. In that Purana, it is said about the Bhagavatam that in it there are many narrations of spiritual instructions, that it begins with the Gayatri Mantra, and that it contains the history of Ritrasura. Anyone who makes a gift of this great work on a full moon day attains to the highest perfection of life by returning to Godhead. There is reference to the Bhagavatam in other Puranas also, where it is clearly stated that this work was finished in 12 cantos, which include 18,000 shlokas. In the Padma Purana also, there is reference to the Bhagavatam in a conversation between Gautam and Maharaj Ambarish. The king was advised therein to read regularly Srimad Bhagavatam if he desired liberation from material bondage. Under the circumstances, there is no doubt about the authority of the Bhagavatam. Within the past 500 years, many erudite scholars and acharyas like Jiva Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti, Vallabhacharya, and many other distinguished scholars, even after the time of Lord Chaitanya, made elaborate commentaries on the Bhagavatam, and the serious student would do well to attempt to go through them to better relish the transcendental messages. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur specifically deals with the original and pure sex psychology, Adi Rasa, devoid of all mundane inebriety. The whole material, Srila Prabhupada, it puts in italics this next sentence, which I'll read now. The whole material creation is moving under the principle of sex life. In modern civilization, sex life is the focal point for all activities. Wherever one turns his face, he sees sex life predominant. Therefore, sex life is not unreal. Its reality is experienced in the spiritual world. The material sex life is but a perverted reflection of the original fact. The original fact is in the Absolute Truth, and thus the Absolute Truth cannot be impersonal. It is not possible to be impersonal and contain pure sex life. Consequently, the impersonalist philosophers have given indirect impetus to the abominable mundane sex life because they have overstressed the impersonality of the ultimate truth. Consequently, man, without information of the actual spiritual form of sex, has accepted perverted material sex life as the all-in-all. There is a distinction between sex life in the diseased material condition and spiritual sex life. The Srimad Bhagavatam will gradually elevate the unbiased reader to the highest perfectional stage of transcendence. It will enable him to transcend the three modes of material activities, fruitive actions, speculative philosophy, and worship of functional deities as inculcated in Vedic verses. So, do you want to swap back? It's easier for me to navigate. Om Agyanatimirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Nama Shrestham Manamapi Shatiputra Matra Sarupam Rupam Tasyaga Jamurupurim Matharim Goshtavatim Radha Kundam Girivaramaho Radhika Madhavasham Prapto Yasya Pratita Kripaya Shrigurum Tam Natosmi Vandeham Shri Guru Shiatafpada Kamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavangs Chashi Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Taitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitam Sajivam Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Yeah, there's so much in every line of Srila Prabhupada's books that could talk for a long time on every line. This Srimad Bhagavatam would be classified among modern anthropologists or students of folk law as wisdom literature. Wisdom being considered insights on the world, or wise statements being considered insights on the world that are uttered, that are concise but profound and very easy to understand, as distinguished from pedantry, which is a lot of book learning but no realization. So there's so many statements of Srila Prabhupada, they're very simply stated but profound and just completely on the point. Just the first line of the purport that I read just, the first line from this purport that I read just now. Unless one surrenders unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, it is certain that he will be bewildered. It's a very simple statement, and you may think, well, yeah, we all know that, we've all been devotees so long, we read all these things, but just so concisely and clearly and just catching the essence of our whole situation in this material world, of the situation of everyone, is just captured in that one very simple sentence. The question often comes from devotees, well, why we've been chanting Hare Krishna for so many years? We are trying to be Krishna conscious. Why are we still in Maya? Why is Maya still attacking us so much? Well, there you got the answer right there. Unless one surrenders unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, it is certain that he will be be bewildered. As much as we surrender to Krishna, that much we are released from Maya. As much as we hold on to Maya, that's the real point. That why is Maya attacking us? It's not that Maya is attacking us so much as we are running after Maya. But in the Bhaktivinoda Thakur sings that I'm running behind you, the Vaishnav, calling Krishna, Krishna. So we're running after Maya, calling, come on, don't leave me. There's a story like that in the Mahabharata, which of one king, as a diversion, kings, they used to have, because they're all so well educated, that we see in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks of Brahmanas and Kshatriyas as eligible persons for going back to Godhead, whereas Stri, Shudra and Vaishya are not considered very eligible. But they can also, if they surrender, same point, if they surrender to Krishna. So King Puna Brahmana Punya Bhaktara Jarshayastata Anityam Asukam Lokam Imam Prapya Bhajasvamam. So what to speak of the brahmanas and saintly kings who in this miserable and temporary world worship me? They can go back to Godhead. So the kings, they're expected to be saintly, knowledgeable. So the diversion in the court is to have the brahmanas, the ministers, discuss on some topic. And see what they come up with. And they can flex their intellectual muscles and show off their learning. And in this way, everyone is entertained. So one time a king in his court, he asked the ministers that, why do we not get free from Maya? So they all gave their different ideas. But the most senior minister, he kept quiet. So after everyone had spoken, they looked to him. What's he got to say? So they're all looking at him, and then all of a sudden he stood up and clasped a pillar in the court and said, let me go, let me go, let me go, please let me go. They thought he'd gone crazy. Then he stopped and said, this is our situation. It's not that Maya's grabbing us, we are grabbing Maya and saying, please let me go. So unless this pithy statement, unless one surrenders under the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, it is certain that he will be bewildered. Srila Prabhupada expresses simply, clearly and precisely what many great transcendentalists only discover after many lifetimes, and some of them don't discover it at all. Manushanang sahasrishu kaschid yadati siddhiya yatatam api siddhanam kaschin maang veti tatpata. Hardly anyone's interested in spiritual life. Those who are, hardly anyone makes any real progress. And those who do attain some kind of perfection, hardly any of them attain the real perfection of surrendering to Krishna. They may do bahunam janmanam ante jnanavam mam prapadyate vasudeva sarvamiti samahatma sudurlabha. After many births of trying to work out what it's all about, someone might come to the point, oh, we're supposed to surrender to Krishna. They got it. But such a great soul is very rare. And Srila Prabhupada just stating it matter-of-factly. It is a matter-of-fact. But just putting it very clearly. So this is wisdom. This is real wisdom. There's wisdom traditions. Many people have insights into the nature of life, and it's a big industry in the modern Western world also, the wisdom industry. That insights in how to manipulate people and how to get workers to work, because you're employing them, but how to get the most out of them. pretend that you like them and all this kind of, how to win friends and influence people was the first of that genre, of which there are new books coming out every day. The 1 minute manager, the 59 second employee, and all this kind of thing. In search of excellence. This is all going back more than 20 years. I have no idea what's... I remember these titles from the days when this was Bhagavan. He was really into this corporate management system, horizontal and vertical. Remember all that? They used to talk about horizontal and vertical lines of management. Covey, yeah, that was another big craze. The win-win is nonsense. There's no win-win in the material world. It's all lose-lose unless you surrender to Krishna. So he has his theories. Coveyitis. There was a severe case of coveyitis in ISKCON. That was also about, 20 years ago, something like that. So they have all their... It's the modern wisdom industry and how to what do they call that? Shrink people, understand what's inside their head and be one step ahead of them and manipulate them in various ways. That's the modern wisdom industry. But even materially, Srila Prabhupada was way, way ahead of everyone else. He recommended, just go to the land and grow your own food. Solution to all the economic problems. Srila Prabhupada, he would often ask his disciples to tell him what the problems are of the world, and Prabhupada will give the solution. So at that time there was a petrol crisis. Who died last month? Covey died. Oh. Well, I didn't hear about it. He must have been a faded star already, because I get to hear most of the news. Stephen Covey died. Rest in peace. That's another hope against hope. Well, a lot of devotees thought kindly of him, so I guess he got some benefit from that. So, the petrol crisis. What was the petrol crisis? Because there's still petrol being pumped out at the rate of millions of barrels a day, probably. So, what's the solution to the petrol crisis, petrol shortage? Prabhupada gave the solution. Don't use petrol. Then you won't have a problem. Stay in your village. You don't need to go anywhere. Just stay in the village, grow your own food. And then the devotees ask, well, what if you need to go anywhere? He said, promise, you take a bullock cart, that's all. You don't need to go anywhere. If you need to go somewhere to the next village, you can walk. Or if you need to carry things, you can put them on the back of a bullock cart. And actually, it's a fact. I mean, the habitable parts of the world, there's enough, the soil is good enough, and there's enough natural materials to produce all that we need for our sustenance. Food, clothing, shelter. Where do they come from? From the stores. No. Food. Here, I'm giving you a lesson here now. You can all write it down in your notebooks. Food mostly comes from the soil. Okay. Soil, you know what that is? You know, the little bits of it in between the concrete. Tarmac, Adam. You can also get food by shooting animals. So one kind of food. We don't take it, but some people do. Catching fish and all this kind of thing. But from milking cows. But they also require grass to eat. So food comes from the land. Clothing, that also, cotton, flax, jute, they're all plants. And wool comes from animals, most famously sheep, also llama's wool, and goats you can also use. Leather is also used as a clothing item, especially for shoes. Shoes could also be made out of wood. And shelter, all over the world, there is material for making houses. Stone and wood, mud, which is, can be clay, can be made into bricks. So you don't need to go anywhere. All you need is there. And some items may be needed to be imported. By imported doesn't necessarily mean from South America, but from some, or from India, but from not too far away. That means just like you may need some cooking pot, so that may not be locally produced. But then there are, in every culture there are festivals, and then there are big fairs, and then traders come to these in different areas, or there may be itinerant merchants who bring these things. Then you can trade that like that. So there's no need to go anywhere. You can stay where you are. And most of the world still lives like that, but it's breaking down gradually. And I lived for some years in a society where that was it. If you wanted to go somewhere, you walked. That's all. People would come to our programs in Bangladesh, up to 20 kilometers. They'd walk. If you want to go somewhere, you walk. Yes, that's all. And generally they wouldn't have any need to go so far. So, Srila Prabhupada had all the solutions to all the problems. Well, people may think, well, that's a great step backward. We've made so much progress. But again, Srila Prabhupada is way ahead of his time. Ahead of his time, behind his time, you could say. There's this idea. When we say he was ahead of his time, or someone would say behind in time, there's the idea that time is linear and we're always making progress. But as we learn, janmadyasya yataha, the past is the future. The future is the past. Time goes in cycles. So, the next yuga is Satya Yuga, but that's already passed, and it's coming again. Won't be exactly the same, but time goes in cycles. So one can know everything, just like Krishna knows everything. Vartaman, what is that? What is that verse? Vedaham samatitani vartamanani charjana bhavishyani cha bhuta mangtu vedana kaschana. One can become like Krishna, trikalagya. By studying Shastra, hearing Shastra, and understanding that what are the general symptoms of life in this material world in different phases of time. Of course, one may not know all the details as Krishna does, but the general pattern one can understand. So, Srila Prabhupada was able to give this knowledge in such a concise and clear manner that even people with no previous exposure to this culture can immediately come to the perfectional stage that otherwise may not be able to be attained by persons who have been practicing spiritual culture for many, many lives. They may practice spiritual culture, but without coming to the point of Krishna, they're not going anywhere very, very quickly. But Srila Prabhupada has given this knowledge. Yeah, so, as Srila Prabhupada sums up some points here that we'll find also in the Tattva Sandarbha, which is Jiva Goswami establishes Srimad Bhagavatam as the topmost evidence, exactly suitable for Kali Yoga, when people don't have time to study so many scriptures. And even if they had time, they don't have the intelligence to understand them all. And many scriptures are missing. They're not extant in the world, in this world today. They may be in other parts of the universe. So Srimad Bhagavatam is the topmost Vedic evidence. Sarvabete itihasanam saram saram hiudahritam. All the knowledge of all the Vedas, all the Puranas, all the corollary literature, it's the very essence of the essence of that is Srimad Bhagavatam. The essence of all Vedic knowledge is Brahmagyan, knowledge of the ultimate reality. That is specifically treated in the Upanishads. And the essence of that essence is Krishna, Srimad Bhagavatam. Just the other day in Los Angeles, a devotee brought me to show. He brought a big pile of books, this 18 Puranas and some Upapuranas and all these books, big piles of books brought into the room. Had his son bring, his son's very big and strong. Maybe he has to carry these books around with him. So became very big and strong. And he's learned many parts of so many, especially many stories from Puranas. There are many stories. So I was reading part of that. But in which the stories are there, but the, you'll find within the stories that the stories about different demigods, and then when they get in trouble, they go to Vishnu and they praise him as supreme. So many stories of the previous lives of different devotees, how they got into such and such a position. And then we brought up the point, yes, but the essence is Srimad Bhagavatam. And then he agreed, yes, of course, Bhagavatam, this is. Even without reading all these books, if one studies Srimad Bhagavatam, that is complete and perfect in itself, even without studying all of this. If one can study also, that's very nice. We're not saying not to. Here in the purport, Srila Prabhupada recommends for the serious student of Bhagavatam, they can further benefit by studying the commentaries of the previous acharyas. So that's another important point, that the other Puranas, they don't have commentaries so much. Many of them, they're at least in the modern age, that means in this Kali Yuga, and the Puranas are especially for Kali Yuga. Previously, well, Puranas are always there, but they're especially recommended for Kali Yuga because people in the modern age, they don't have so much intelligence. We think people have a lot of intelligence in the modern age. You see, we made computers and we made space rockets and we made all kinds of things to improve life, contraceptives and mass slaughterhouses and all other things. So we're very intelligent. And the idea is that civilization really began with the written word. That's when intellectual life could begin. And previous to that, there was only hieroglyphics and people grunting at each other. But the Vedic knowledge is that the symptom of the degradation of civilization is the introduction of the written word. Because people are so stupid, you have to write things down. Otherwise, people just remember. Hear and remember, that's all. You hear it, you remember it. Then there's no need for writing. So it's actually a sign of a degradation of civilization, not advancement of civilization, that there's writing. And still today, that system is going on in India and some places. The Gurukuls, the boys are taught the Vedas just by hearing. Not just once they'll hear, but they have to hear over and over again. There's a system of teaching them. You teach one word, and then two words together, and like this. So still that's going on. Although mostly they're not taught the meaning, they're just taught to recite the Vedas. But what the meaning of it is, they don't know. But they learn it, and it's considered auspicious to learn it. Doesn't make any sense to you. Later they could use it, but mostly they become Karmakanda priests, those who learn the Vedas. But that's considered important, that anyone who's going to become a Karmakanda priest, they have to learn one Veda, at least whatever's left of it. They're not all Karmakanda, there's some Vaishnavas also, and few here and there. Then they become temple priests, which is better than becoming a Karmakanda priest. They may do both also. Anyway, what was I talking about? In Kali Yuga, the Puranas are considered more important because people can't understand the import of the Vedas in the modern age. But the topmost scripture that's accepted, except by envious people, is Srimad Bhagavatam. The Devi Bhagavat has been made as a... It's all the stories of Bhagavatam, but instead they put Durga and make Vishnu subordinate to her. That's been invented as a rival to the Srimad Bhagavatam by the Shakta community, those who worship Durga. But it's not mentioned in any of the lists of the Puranas. It's something made up. It was made up some time ago, so people think that makes it more authentic. Devi Bhagavat. It's quite well known in India, you'll find. It's all over India, so. But it's not mentioned in the old lists, huh? Yeah, it's a big book. Yeah. But you'll find in all the stories that Vishnu is praying to Durga as supreme, like this. they just twist it all around. But Srimad. It's actually a big point, a big topic. If you want to get into it, with an antagonist. They can bring all kinds of arguments. But we don't bother so much with that. It may not be so much necessary in the West unless you get into it with these Indologists. But they're also not serious people. The Indologists, the people who study all this stuff professionally, they may know a lot. They may in some ways know more than our devotees about the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, of different sampradayas, but we can't take them very seriously. They're not serious about spiritual life at all. Satsvarup Das Goswami, he relates in one of his writings how when he was leading the BBT library party, which Srila Prabhupada very much wanted that Srila Prabhupada's books be placed in all the college and university libraries. So he was leading up a party for doing that. So at one point he was invited to a meeting of Indologists, and these were like the top Indologists. Well, there weren't that many, but they included the top Indologists in America. So he was excited to go and thought they're completely mundane people. And one of them was telling a story of how he was with a friend in India. And they came to a little puddle, but they were both stoned on dope, so they thought it was a huge river, and like this. And they were making irreverent jokes. I didn't read it personally, but someone told me that there's a book by Alan Entwistle, who's one of these, whoops, but don't put it on the internet, I'm going to get a libel case against me. Anyway, if it's true, if it's in the book, it is. He's written some books on Vrindavan and the culture of Vrindavan. In one of his books, he writes how he was doing Govardhan Parikrama and that he saw one young woman walking along and he took her hand and started walking with her. What kind of woman was that? Very strange. I mean, an average woman in India, if you just walk up to her and take her hand, she wouldn't take it, but... Anyway, maybe he was doped and didn't. Maybe it was a cow he'd got a hold of also. I don't know. But these people we can't take very seriously. Of course, they're influential in some ways, but for spiritual life, the best thing is if you see any of these people, you turn around in the opposite direction and walk away or run away. Well, you could interact with them with the idea of giving them a better idea, but it's very difficult because they already know everything. What are they going to learn from you? They just read the books. They don't follow anything in it. That is antithetical to being a scholar. So, Srila Prabhupada writes here, the serious student would do well to attempt to go through the commentaries of the Acharyas, and he includes among the commentators, interestingly, Vallabhacharya, who Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he wasn't very pleased with Vallabha. Well, Srila Prabhupada commented later, it was a friendly relationship, but Vallabha, his idea was that he could give a better idea than Sridharaswami. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't accept that. So Vallabha, he wrote his own commentary on Bhagavatam without reference to Sridharaswami. But Srila Prabhupada says we can better understand by going through the commentaries also. But who has time for that? For reading? Some few people, they can have time, they can study. Maybe retired in old age, they can read all this. And some study, just like Aradha Govinda Maharaj of ISKCON, he studies especially Vishwanath Chakravarti's commentaries. And then he speaks on that, so others can benefit by hearing. Dinabandhu Prabhu told me once in Vrindavan at ISKCON Krishna Balaram Mandir that Radha Govinda Maharaj was giving a katha, and all the ashrams around, everyone was from their own ashram. They'd sit on the roof and they were all listening to that. So that's right. So we can benefit by hearing from others who have gone through all of this. Not everyone can study everything. There's so much to study. Some devotees should specialize in this. Study, understand, bring out the different points. There's so much research work to do, for instance, to combat all the wrong ideas given by so many Panditamani, persons who think they are very learned. But even to do that, one should have good training in serving, washing pots, cleaning floors, going on book distribution, going on Harinam. Otherwise, if you just become a scholar without that surrender, then what will happen is that unless one surrenders under the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, it is certain that he will be bewildered, even if you read so many books. Even if you read very good books by the Acharyas, even if you read Prabhupada's books, unless we actually surrender to Krishna, then we will be bewildered. So we have to be careful also while ascending into the mental realms, that our feet are firmly placed, we're firmly grounded in the atmosphere of surrender to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. Okay, so much more could be said, but I won't say more now unless there's... You read my mind. He's getting mystic powers. Of course, it wasn't that difficult. I was going to ask for questions. I see. Trikalagya. What happened to Trikalagya, Prabhu? He was in America for some time. That was a long time ago. He was a prominent devotee in our movement at one time.
Guru Maharaj, in the pre-industrial times, the system for retirement was to raise sons and then sons would take care of you. So, you know, father would have an estate, a property, a farm.
You don't have another mic, is it? Can you all hear way back there? You can. Well, maybe my power of hearing is diminishing along with the tick, 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 the time going on. Yeah.
So the father would work the land to produce food and the necessities that need to be helped by his sons, especially when he would grow old.
Yeah.
The sons would take care of him.
Well, that would be Vaishyas who have some land. And they would produce food, and then the sons would look after them when they get old. Yeah.
So how does the mathematics work here? You have one property, one father, but then there are two sons, or maybe even three.
Many sons, yeah. How does it work?
It almost seems...
Well, it did work.
It's inevitable that we eventually always reach the industrial times as people are multiplying.
As the population increases. Well, the system until recently was that the property was actually transferred to the eldest son. And then the younger brothers would serve him and look out to him as they did the father, following the example of Ramachandra Bhagavan with his younger brothers. In that way, the property remained intact. It wasn't divided. That changed in the time of Indira Gandhi. She changed that rule. And that was a major factor in breaking down the old culture of India. How would that be enough to support everyone? Well, that would be a matter of more research, I guess. But one factor would be that the death rate was quite high also. At least in India, seems to be quite disturbed due to health, upheavals due to war and all that. Well, that's not very good. Much of India until recently also was forest. Even at the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, I happen to know because I researched that, even much of the land which is now farming land was forest land. So if there was increase of population, some of the land could be cleared for that. And some sons, they might go away, or a Vaishya, he could also be awarded land by the king, especially if he went to some other place. Sometimes they would go and found a new city. There'd be a forest, just like in the time of Ramachandra. He sent Shatrughna to found the city of Mathura. There was nothing there. He founded it so that city means there's all the hinterland around it. So there's always some room for expansion. Even now, the world can easily feed all the citizens of it if it was properly managed. I mean, people of the world are being fed, but it's an uneven distribution system. But so much land is used for growing grains to feed animals for slaughter, which is not required. And so much land is used for growing opium and cocaine for illicit, and tobacco, and for making crops, for making alcohol. All these things are not required. Coffee, tea, chocolate, all these things are not required. So even now the earth can support the present population, what to speak of previously. How it would work if the land becomes not enough? Well, we have this idea of owning land, but as I understand it, again, it may need more research, but in the Vedic system, the land is, everything is under the jurisdiction of the king, and so, like that. If there's a Vaishya who needs to be engaged but he doesn't have scope, then he can bring his case to the king. And it's the king's duty to see that everyone is fully engaged, so he can allocate some land.
It seems that over time you again are sort of bound to end up with the industrial civilization because of the increase of population.
The increase of population inevitably leads to industrial civilization. How does that work, seeing as our necessities are food, clothing and shelter, and industry doesn't provide that?
That is correct, but the rajasic, the passionate urge is there. Is, you know,
the rajasic urge is there to... If there are more and more people, people become more and more competitive. We may think like that, but it's not necessarily true. We have descriptions of Dwarka in the time of Krishna, and there are so many people living. We tend to judge society by by our preconceptions, and that's one thing that anthropologists have... Some of them have the idea that we shouldn't study. Originally, when the so-called science or pseudoscience of anthropology was being established, they were studying different societies throughout the world, using their own. Still, of course, they do that, but using their own social preconceptions. Just like the idea that people will work more if you give them more money, but it's not necessarily true. Money is a motivating factor, but if there's, just like in Soviet times in Russia, that couldn't motivate anyone because money wouldn't, you can't buy anything with the money, so there's no use to work to get more money. Or one godbrother who was constructing wooden houses on a property he'd purchased in South India, a godbrother of mine from America. And it was going on slowly, much more slowly than he as an American desired. So the contractor he had hired, he said, "Look, I want to get this done quickly. Tell them I'll pay them double and then they'll work harder." And the contractor said, "No, don't do that." But he bypassing the contractor, it was a daily wage basis, he paid the people double. And the next day they didn't come to work. So he asked the contractor, "Why didn't they come?" He said, "Well, they have enough food for they have enough money for their food, so when they need some more, they'll come back again." So they are, and there are cultures, I was just reading that recently. There are cultures, or there have been cultures, in which earning and possessing, well, certainly the Brahminical culture of ancient India was poverty. If there was any, first of all, they weren't interested in prestige, and if there was any prestige, it was by how austerely you can live, not how luxuriously you can live, because that means you're more detached, which is supposed to be a sign of a greater brahmana. But in many cultures, there was the that there's no there wasn't selling or buying. There's only giving, and one's prestige is actually enhanced by giving. How much you can give? Where was I reading? I was reading this recently that in the Odyssey, there's a story of how one king called Odysseus, and then he gave away to Odysseus and his party huge amounts, so much gifts. You know, you're from Greece.
Well, that in particular story, I vaguely can remember that, but I was going to give another example from Roman civilization.
Yeah, well, let me finish this one first. And the idea was that if you can give so much, Odysseus had just turned up on his shores, and then the idea was that he gave huge, tremendous gifts to Odysseus and all his men, with the idea that Odysseus would go back to wherever he came from, and tell the other people about there's this king who gives so much without no expectation of return. Yeah, what were you going to say?
In ancient Roman civilization also, the system was that the aristocracy, they would, most of the population of Rome, 1 million people about, half were slaves, but the ones who were free, a lot of times they were very poor, only the senators had money and the emperors had tremendous wealth. Mm. And what they would do is every morning they would wake up, and then they would have patrons, all the wealthy men, the senators in Rome, they would have long lines in front of their house and their doors would always be open as a symbol of their aristocracy, you can come and ask me. And every morning they would come and give out a wage allotment to the people. They would just come line up, and then the senators would just give free money, and they would have enough money for food, and sometimes they would visit a couple of these patrons again. Mm. And it was a sign of prestige. The senator,
the more you give, the more you give. Yeah. Mm. And not that everyone was earning independently. It's a big discussion, but the point is that I was saying in anthropology there are two perspectives. One is called etic and the other is called emic. And emic means the idea, if you want to understand a people, you have to go and live with them and you have to adopt their whole way of thinking and acting. And etic means you just study it with your own preconceived notions. So the idea that that the increase of population must necessarily, because people are competitive.
But it has already happened.
It has happened, but that doesn't mean it has to happen in every society. If there's higher knowledge, then why should people compete for material advantage?
There was higher knowledge.
Yeah. Well, it's a sign of Kali. Yeah, in Kali Yuga, industrialization is inevitable. That is a fact. But it's not necessarily in every society that it is inevitable. It wouldn't have happened in most of the world if the profits of industrialization hadn't carried it everywhere, and if they didn't want to expand their markets everywhere. I saw in the airport this HSBC. They have these advertisements, and one of the advertisements, Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, they had their... They had an advertisement, in the future there will be no new markets to expand into. So take our advice to help you get the ones which are still open. It's like they're there everywhere. The modern civilization reaching every corner of the earth. So there are no people who are left free from it. They are being forcibly civilized. And there are so many cases of people. Recently in South India, when this Akinchan Krishna, your godbrother, I don't know if you know him, he's from the deep south, so of South India. So he told me that under some government scheme, one tribe that was living in the forest were brought out of the forest and given all modern amenities and this and that. And after 2 years, the head of the tribe said, "Let's get out of here, we're going back to the forest." He wasn't happy, and they all followed him and just went back to their forest ways. The idea they have to become civilized. The idea is become civilized means they need more factory workers. So, yeah, it's not necessarily that... In many societies, the people were not... competitive, they were cooperative. And even within, just like one joint family, that was... These big business houses in India have grown up. One reason they're able to do so is due to cooperation between the family members, between the brothers and the father and all this. And you see this Dhirubhai Ambani, he was a self-made man. Then after he died, his two brothers famously fought each other bitterly in the courts. But another of the big business family, I know there's a deviation from the topic we're talking about here, but necessary. If you go into social issues, you have to start talking about all this. But another very, very wealthy person who comes to our temples regularly in London and Bombay is this Sri Chandin Hinduja. And his younger brother is always with him and working with him, Gopi Chand. So they worked. If you have two smart Sindhi businessmen, or a whole family of the Bialas, another example, the Biala dynasty. There's a whole dynasty of Bialas all working together, and so Mittal also, always with his son. Yeah, this Kingfisher. What's that guy's name?
Vijay Malaya.
Yeah, he gave, when his son became 18 years old, he set up an airline and gave it to him, and it's collapsed. But that was his birthday present to his son when he was 18 years old, an airline company. I guess that was because previously one of those Ambanis had given his wife an airplane for her birthday present. So to outdo him, the Malaya gave a whole airline company to his son. So like that, the idea, they've been very successful, but due to cooperation like that. And there are many smaller family businesses which work like that, apart from the big ones. So at least among themselves, due to unquestioning cooperation with obedience to the father or the elder brother, then they've been able to develop outside their competitive, but inside their cooperative. So that's a matter of culture also. In modern society in the West, it breeds that competitive culture, and we presume that that's the way people have to live. But you grew up in a different culture, right? You didn't grow up in a competitive culture.
No, there was never... None of my friends ever thought of becoming rich or anything. Like, yeah. Endeavoring for something like that.
There's no question. And people will help each other in times of need, unquestioningly. If someone's sick, then someone will help them. Or if someone has an apple tree in their garden, and when the apples are in season, what are you going to do with so many apples anyway? So all the neighbors, they come and take whatever they like this. So, time. All right. I have to follow the elder brother. He's telling me it's time to stop all this wandering talks. This wandering talks, which Srila Prabhupada did also discuss social matters a lot, because he wanted to bring in a change in the world. So we have to understand all these points. We're very strongly conditioned by our background, even though we read Prabhupada's books. That's why it's actually very useful to... It's also part of the education, as Chanika Pandit says, to travel. It's also part of education. Not necessary for everyone. Some people stay in their one place all their life and they become their most learned. We see there are some like Vedanta Deshika. He just spent all his life in... actually two places, but then he was in such a highly learned and wise person. But in general, it's a good education to see different parts of the world. If one is intelligent, otherwise you can be a wandering fool. So, Hare Krishna, this rambling talk I'll bring to an end just now. Hare Krishna! All glories to Srila Prabhupada.